You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is your host for the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Sims. I'm here at the 35th Great Basin Anthropological Conference in Reno, Nevada, and I've got Randy Ottenhoff here. Him and I were talking in one of the conference rooms outside of the presentations about his research on incised stones. So we'll hear from him about his pretty fascinating work. So, Randy, can you give me a little bit of a background on, where you're working on and what your research was?
Right. So I focused on incised stones of the Great Basin. My inspiration for that started when I was an undergraduate at UC Davis. And I worked on a collection of incised stones from Ruby Cave. It was great. It was a great experience. And I started to look at what literature was available and really noticed that these had been understudied. There was literature, but it was, I felt then it was lacking. And yeah. There was a lot more to be said.
So your research was like pioneering in a lot of ways then?
Well, it's important to remember other people had done some work. Mm-hmm. Janice Klimowitz had, she did her master's in 1988 from UNR. Uh-huh. So she had looked at a collection called the Santini Collection, in which she made a typology, a design classification.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So she did that work. And then there was Trudy Thomas, who did work at Gatecliffe on the incised stones there.
Yeah.
So she did that. Of course, David Hurst Thomas also did some early research on incised stones, and there was others, but it looked to me like there was a lot of unanswered questions.
Yeah,
and so I wanted to, I at an early time in my archaeological career, I really was interested in what associations, things that are associated in context. So,
yeah.
And I wanted to really take that to the incised stones, and I had big questions. What are these incised stones associated with?
Yeah,
and I wanted a threshold for that. I wanted to get a tight handle on a small area. So I started looking at what that could be, and the archaeological sites that I used, which were Gatecliffe Rock Shelter and Swallow Shelter,
uh-huh,
and Hogup Cave, Camelsback Cave, and Ruby Cave, they had good provenience within 1.5 meters.
Oh, nice.
And so that was my threshold.
Yeah.
that I used. And so I went to the University of Central Lancashire in Preston, England.
Yeah.
And it was a great experience there. We had, when I started my research, I knew that I needed to do a lot of museum research.
Yeah.
I had a discussion early on with my director of studies, who is Dr. David Robinson, and we both agreed it would probably be advisable not to stick a shovel in Nevada looking for incised stones, because looking at the size and scope of Gatecliffe and Hogup Cave and Swallow Shelter and the depth at which those sites went, at the time I thought, well, I'm gonna look to see. These are my sample sites. They've already been excavated, and there's lots of radiocarbon dates available. And so I made a decision early on that I was going to do a lot of museum research.
Okay.
So I...
because you could spend like a lifetime excavating caves.
Yeah, and I could do that later in my career.
Yeah.
I decided. So yeah, it was probably a good idea. So yeah. I did my literature search. Early in my investigation, I wanted to know about these Insight stones, not just in the Great Basin, but I started to realize that there was Insight stones found worldwide. Uh-huh. And Bloembos Cave in South Africa, Henselwood had reported in a published paper about these engraved, he called them engraved ochres that dated to 175,000 years ago.
Whoa.
And it's really early stuff. And I used that when I started my lit search. I really used that to as a jumping off place. And when I started looking at more research that had been done in Africa, I realized that there was more Insight stones found in Zimbabwe and Morocco, and dating in at 30,000, 27,000 years ago. And so I decided, a whole chapter is dedicated to that in my PhD. So it's, yeah, is this worldwide phenomena of Insight stones. And so I sketched out continent by continent what evidence has been found. It turns out there's, in Europe, there's quite a number of these Insight stones, especially in Spain, in Portugal, there in France. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Neolithic Insight stones that were made that are spectacular to look at.
Weird.
Yeah, there's even some of the research, some of it is tied in with mortuary, type of archaeology.
Gotcha. So they were like burial goods.
They were found in burial goods. Yeah. So there is an early report in a report called Materialitas is what they called it. And I feel really bad. A researcher that escapes my memory at the moment, she and another person, she worked on finding, she came up with this idea that perhaps the Insight stones that were entombed with the dead, uh-huh, had absorbed the fluids from the dead and had darkened in color. And she hypothesized that perhaps in that way, the Insight stones became a transportation device of the dead. If you were to go back, whoa, and take it away, then wherever you go, it's going to be infused with that person.
Wow.
Yeah, really interesting. So, of course, in the Russian plains, there's Insight stones found there, and then there's in the Middle East.
Yeah.
There's a number. There's some found near Jerusalem. There's in Japan. There's Insight stones found in Japan. So it's everywhere, and even in South America, there's Insight stones found there too.
That's crazy.
It is crazy. And so in North America. The Clovis site, the Galt site in Texas,
uh-huh,
is, I think, the earliest Insight stone site that we have. And the Galt site is, and then we have in the Great Basin, we have Cowboy Cave. And there's some really early dates for Cowboy Cave where there's one Insight stone that was found during what would be a Clovis, almost a pre-Clovis.
Whoa.
Occupation, but I stayed in my sample. I didn't use Cowboy Cave. That early date is a really wide radiocarbon date error, and I decided to use Camelsback Cave at that time.
Nice.
All right. So moving forward with that, I had gone to the Utah Museum of Natural History, where I did a lot of collecting of as much provenience information I can of Camelsback Cave. and Hog Up Cave and Swallow Shelter.
Yeah.
And they was great. I scanned over 2,000 pages of original field notes that I took, I had taken. And then I had, of course, there's already done research at UC Davis on the Ruby Cave stone. So I already had a lot of data from there. And I had all the pictures. And I photographed all the stones. I spent a lot of time studying these stones, sitting down and looking at them.
Yeah.
So I went back and I did the task of recreating the original excavation floors for these sites. That Camelsback Cave did have and published. They had the faunal remains of some of the levels, the horizons that they were using for. They were using for a faunal analysis, a spatial faunal analysis. So. But they didn't have any inside stone. So I recreated the earlier levels at Camelsback Cave using their provenance information, and I used Illustrator.
Yeah.
And I basically just made all of my own symbols and for the artifacts, and so I placed that all back together. And then I did the same thing for Hog Up Cave, and each one of these took a lot of time because it was almost like decoding notation. I went on, it was like a big hunt over all of these documents to reconfigure how it all went together.
Yeah.
And I contacted Mel Akins when I had a working sketch of the inside of the cave for Hog Up Cave. And then so I had a working sketch, you know, an Illustrator for the cave walls, and then I recreated the original grid based off of the just a couple of notations that they had, and then looking at the extents of how deep they dug and how far their units went.
You're getting back to the associations of everything.
Yeah, the associations.
Not just the inside stones, but... everything that was contained around it.
Yeah, everything was contained around it. Cool. So in doing that, I started to realize that, actually these units, some of the units at Hog Up Cave, they go further underneath the wall after they started digging than was what you see published. You know? And so I had some big questions about that.
Yeah.
So I sent my stuff to Mel Akins, and I introduced myself in email, and I asked him if he could take a look at these and tell me, are these accurate? And he got back to me, and it was great. We got into a back and forth email chatter about these walls of the cave, the original grid that they used, and the numbering system they used for each unit. And we really... he was instrumental in reproducing all of that, and so we got it all back together. And I started to then make more symbols for more artifacts.
Yeah.
So by the time I was done, I had made 140 artifact symbols for all of these sites.
Yeah.
I did that, and then I did the same thing for Ruby Cave, and of course I did the same thing for Swallow Shelter.
Uh-huh.
And I even had contacted Dally, who excavated Swallow Shelter, on the phone, and I had a chat with him. So it was a great experience, just redoing, doing this and finding these associations and all of these maps. It was a great experience. And once it was done, I seriously started to look at those parameters that I was talking about, those 1.5 meter parameters. Now, I should say that Gatecliff already has their spatial maps published in the Gatecliff monograph.
Yeah.
And so in book two. So I didn't spend any time reproducing those.
Yeah, you didn't have to like reinvent the wheel with
them. No, I didn't have to reinvent the wheel. So I started looking at what was associated, and I started to realize that, hey, you know, these inside stones, they're not found by themselves, tucked away in some corner of the cave, away from everything. These are out in public display. They're mixed with tools, you know, out. They're mixed with awls and arrow shaft straighteners. They're found with component materials, things that you like reeds for basket making. They were with moccasin material, you know, things like that. They were with bone needles, you know, a lot of tools, a lot of component materials, and in some instances, some of the finished artifacts.
Yeah.
And so, I knew that there was increases in incised stone numbers through time, in on individual site basis, and I wanted to understand that greater. So what I started to do is I started looking at the greater environmental picture. I wanted to build a background of what was happening at these sites when incised stone numbers increase and decrease. And so as I did that research, I started to realize that incised stone numbers increase when the weather conditions, the climate conditions are most favorable. And I did that by looking at the pollen data.
Oh, nice.
So I looked at the pollen data and made an inference to say that when there's a large amount of pollen for different species of plants, then that is an indicator of more favorable early rain conditions that these pollinating plants were able to be more prolific in the Great Basin if they had a lot of water available. And that, to me, that was an indicator that there was more resources available at that site at the time. And so
That's interesting how these stones are like indicators of all sorts of different things going on.
Yeah, there's all kinds of different things going on. And I started to really look at there's ground stone. In a lot of instances, during the first time these incised stones appear, there's other artifacts that appear at the same time, like ground stone starts to appear at the same time. Some of those component materials I was talking about, you know, of course we're dealing with dry caves and rock shelters, so they have really good preservation. So they had, you know, lots of stuff starts to come in, stone balls that may have been used for hide preparation, rubbing hides down, and that kind of thing starts to appear. And so you have a whole new dimension at these sites of huge range of activities happening. And incised stones come along with that. And in some instances, especially like at Hog Up Cave, incised stones start to come in at the same time the altithermal is ending. There was a lot more rain and more the marshes that existed along the edge of the Great Salt Lake during the end of the Holocene, that actually started to vanish because the lake started to refill, and with the refilling of the lake, the marshes started to disappear.
Oh.
So I'm sure that the people had to make some decisions about how they're going to use the land differently, and it seems that they started using uphill sites a lot more,
moving away from
and it correlates really nicely because the number of shoreline birds start to diminish in Hog Up Cave, but they continue to harvest local plants. Because there's seeps and springs near Hog Up Cave. Right? So they started to exploit uphill, and that's the time where Hog Up Cave gets used a lot more. So, and that's kind of the same picture going on at a lot of these sites.
Huh.
Even at Camel's Back Cave, when the first incised stones happen there, the altithermal was just getting started. It was really hot. Yet, in the face of that, Camel's Back Cave, you have these trees. You have pine trees, the pinyon harvest starting up, and you had all of these, you had seeds that were available, and so that was being exploited there.
Nice.
And so it ties in even there. There was the resources. There was an ability to stay a long period of time.
Okay.
So I had done some early research with looking at Janice Klimowitz's research that she did in 1988 on Insight Stones and her classification. She had made these classifications of designs on the Insight Stones.
Yeah.
And when I first read it, I kind of thought, I don't know if these really exist. Honestly, I wasn't a big fan of the typologies of it. And then, after I had examined thousands of these Insight Stones, I went back and I reread her work, and I reread it again, and I thought, these really do exist.
Yeah.
These classifications that she came up with from an Insight Stone collection in Southern Nevada do exist in my collection from Utah and from Northern Nevada.
Oh, cool.
So that caused me to go back. I went back, I used her typology system, and I used that system to classify all the designs on the stones I was using. And I then got really curious. Well, wait, if these designs are like that, well, is there designs associated with certain material culture? So then on all of my maps, I coded all of the Insight Stones based on these classifications, and I went back to the drawing board in a way, and I started looking seriously, like, okay, well, this is the curvilinear design, and I wrote down everything that curvilinear design is associated with, and everything that the bisect design is associated with, and I started feeding that into my Excel database, and I started looking at the numbers, and there's a measurable difference based on classification of what the Insight Stone is found with.
Huh.
So for like the curvilinear design, it's pretty clear that the they're associated with like gaming dice or gaming sticks. And then there's like the bisect design was associated with lots of projectile points. And that sort of thing. And then another design is associated with these component materials and awls. And another one, and so it almost seems like they're grouped.
Yeah.
And so I had that. So I had taken these. It's important to remember that these designs are recurrent in the Great Basin. And that's true if you're in Southern Nevada. It's true if you're in Northern Nevada. It's true if you're in Utah or California. These designs are recurrent. And I really liked how Janice had talked about it in terms of a design grammar. So there's some sort of grammar to these designs, but we just don't really understand what that is. So it's something that's internally logic to the people who made it, but not maybe to us.
Yeah. Right?
And so with all of that, I had the background climate data. I had the technology changes that sort of happened, the technology that was brought in at the same time Insight Stones occurred, some of the demographics of the people, and their movement through the landscape, and I took all of that, and I started to notice at times when you have declining declining or no numbers of incised stones in sites that previously had incised stones, you have a different set, a different assemblage of artifacts. And at the same time, you have a declining environment, a declining climate in that same locale of the site that probably didn't make it very attractive to hunter-gatherers to go to as a residential base.
Yeah.
So you had less people. And I know less people equals less incised stones. But you still had artifacts happening. And the assemblage was mostly hunting technology assemblages at times when you don't have a lot of incised stones. And so I interpreted that to suggest that at the time that logistical hunters probably didn't make incised stones.
So at those times, logistical hunters were just visiting these caves as like a hunting camp or something like that.
That's right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. And that at times when it was used more by the whole group, and when I say the whole group, it was some sort of residential base. Once again, I don't know for how long, maybe a week's, months, but it was used by these people for a period of time. And that you had women and you had children, and you had probably, if there was any elderly staying there, you had a whole group there at those times. And so that's when incised zones are made.
Very interesting.
So they're not made, I don't think they're made by logistical hunters. They're made by whole groups of people staying together. And that probably means something else that I don't know how well covered this is in the literature, but hunter-gatherers probably used an early springtime reconnaissance system of going to these sites before they made decisions on how they were going to travel in the landscape.
Huh.
And they probably made judgments on these reconnaissance missions to, you know, go back and report to the whole group what they found, and then that's how they chose where to travel for the probably the best survival routine.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's so many questions about these stones then. So like, would these stones be a signal to anybody on a reconnaissance mission that these caves would be like an ideal habitat or place to visit?
I don't think so. I think by the time that if you were going on a reconnaissance mission, I don't think that's what they were. I think what ultimately these incised stones are telling us is that if you're going to have a cultural system of learning, if you're going to pass on learning and memory, you're going to have a time where you are hunkered down, not going to go anywhere for a little while, so you can teach your material culture to the youth.
Oh, wow.
And so so in a way, I interpreted these incised stones as being a rite of passage for people being initiated on how to make material culture. And that, to me, I think explains why you have different placements of designs with different assemblages. And when I say assemblage, I mean, to me, an assemblage is it would be something like awls and groundstone and, hide processing balls and, or a different assemblage would be projectile points, arrows and shaft straighteners and, these are these kinds of assemblages that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why you have differences in association there.
Yeah.
And you have these contexts happening. Is I think these things could have very well been made by the youth.
Wow.
Both men and women at maybe an early age. So that leaves a question, though. To me, it seems like they left him behind.
Yeah.
And it's not something that they walked around with. Now, maybe that was just practical to not walk around with what you've made. It was sufficient enough to make it and leave it behind.
Right.
In much the same way that you maybe you make something and leave it on the wall.
Yeah.
But, you know, or you don't take there's certain things, certain pieces of art that you might make and then not walk around everywhere with, right? You know?
So, like, the incised stones then clearly aren't utilitarian objects, right?
I think that I don't know if I would call them utilitarian, but they were cultural markers of people's activities of I think they were involved somehow with the process of learning.
Okay.
And I think that they were involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that you don't find very, very infrequently with incised stones is depictions of people. And very, very infrequently do you find depictions of animals.
Huh.
It's very, very small amount. And what you get is a lot of geometric shapes and designs.
Interesting.
And that's different. There is some evidence at Gatecliff Shelter where... I think it's Horizon 6, where you have 92 incised stones in a 2-meter area, and above that is rock art that seems to be very it seems to be very geometrically shaped in itself. Almost as if though it's a reflection of the two.
Gotcha.
And I know that Trudy Thomas pointed that out in her work also, and I think that that's really an interesting. Now, it's difficult to place in time, not space, but in time when the two occurred. Did the rock art and the incised stones occur at the same time,
mm-hmm.
or are they separated by hundreds of years? That's a real difficulty.
Yeah.
But There is a context happening there. There's this association happening there that's interesting. And it comes at a time at Gatecliff that seems that it was a depression in resources, not only there but in other places. So I know that Georgia Lee had at an early time talked about crisis art. and I kind of thought, well, maybe this is a crisis art happening here, and it's set into a structured deposition, and so it's like a structured deposition is something that is it's a deposit in a structured way,
okay,
in the simplest form.
Does that imply intention?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very intentionally done. It started with Durrington Walls in England in 1982. It was the first time that was mentioned, and so they were looking at these pits that had some pits had flint, and some pits that didn't. They had something else, and so they were looking at these as being intentionally excluded. These excluded items in different pits, and they described that as being a structural deposition.
Oh, neat.
And so at Gatecliff at that time, I think there's a structural deposition happening.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, maybe it indicates, maybe that particular time indicates a delve into why these incised stones were even more important. It's maybe that was tied to some sort of spiritual belief.
Okay.
So maybe they thought that they hadn't given thanks for what they have. And they left the incised stones in this big structure deposition to make the weather better.
Huh.
Since it, you know, and maybe that is, you know, it's really speculative. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like maybe they had some sort of connection with this idea that, you know, we haven't given thanks for what we have, or we haven't, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But getting back to... what this all means for incised stones is that it means that incised stones finally has a context in the Great Basin.
Yeah.
So when you find an Ansai stone, it comes wrapped with meaning now, because it's something that you, when you find it and you pick it up, you can say, hey, this might mean that there was a large group of people who stayed here for a somewhat longer period of time, and that they were making new artifacts, and they were doing hunting here, and they were hunkered down, and this actually might show like some sort of process of learning and passing on of material culture know-how onto the youth. And it also means that it comes wrapped with meaning, saying, hey, you know, this could mean that the climate at that time was such that made this site really attractive to them.
Yeah.
It made it really like, hey, let's go there. There's lots we can go there and hunker down. There's lots of activity happening, both vegetation and the gaming animals. There's small critters, there's big critters to hunt. Yeah. You know, hey, let's go there because we can live good there for a while.
Yeah.
And we can collect up a bunch of stuff. And you can teach and pass on our culture to others. And I think these insight stones seem to now have that context. And it's a hypothesis that is testable.
Yeah.
Because I use these rock shelters and caves. What I didn't use in my sample was open air sites.
Yeah.
And so that's really the next place that this research can go, is looking at these open air sites, testing this hypothesis.
Are you finding incised stones on open air sites?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's definitely incised stones at open air sites. Not every site has incised stones.
Yeah.
But the ones that do, I'm saying has a lot of meaning as to what was happening in the demographics, in the climate, and the technology, and the activities that they were performing. I'm saying that when you find one, it comes wrapped with all of this meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then the next step is to test, like, ideally you would hope to find like sealed contexts on open air sites with incised stones. Then you want to test if similar conditions apply there.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, exactly. So, so my PhD really concluded with Sarah Winnemucca describing the flower dance. And she describes that females are either named after flowers or rocks.
Uh-huh.
And that when the dance is first announced, the girls have 2 weeks in order to collect up either the flower they're named after or collect the rock they're named after. And she describes that the girls who collect the flowers, they weave those into their hair, they weave those into their clothing, they make things out of the flowers, and then during the dance, they dance around in a circle and they sing a song about how, I think, how pretty they are, and before they're joined with their significant other.
Yeah.
She never ever talks about what the girls named after rocks do. So I took that to think, well, maybe they were making incised stones with them also, you know.
Yeah.
It's another possibility. So it's there's some lines there. There's some lines of logic that can be used to discuss these incised stones, hypotheses that can be tested.
Yeah.
There's a lot, and there's a lot more research that just can be done.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's so many questions involved with that.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Are there any other things you'd like to say about the incised stones?
No, I not at the moment. I don't have any other thing I want to say at the moment.
Yeah.
They're pretty awesome piece of material culture.
Yeah.
And I just feel so lucky to have been able to study them.
Yeah.
You know, and to be able to meet all the people that have an interest also, and to give talks at conferences, and I just count myself as really lucky and really really fortunate to do that.
And that's awesome.
Yeah, and I really do think like everybody who's been who's helped me,
yeah,
and you know, given me advice, and yeah, absolutely.
That's really cool. Well, I also think it's amazing that you've been able to like contribute, like the contribution you've offered through this research is to, like you said, finally give a context to, you know, like the symbology and the ceremonies and the behavior. You know, mm-hmm. it adds like a whole new depth of meaning to these sites rather than just, you know, like typical like ecological studies. Like, oh, well, you know, things are better over here. So we've got people over here. Now we've got like, well, it's not just people over here because conditions are better. It's like you also have transmission of knowledge to youth and yeah. you've got like a whole like, you know, sphere of activity going on now. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. It's definitely things, all things to keep in mind and to keep thinking about and expand upon. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. Well, I can't wait to hear more of your research as you know you keep working on this.
Yeah, and I am still working on it. I'm working on a paper I'm planning on publishing in the Holocene soon, and I'm working on that with Dr. David Robinson, uh-huh. who's my director of studies. So, and then I'm working on a paper that I hope to get published in American Antiquities, uh-huh. Discussing some historical artifacts that were found at Hagup Cave, almost completely unrelated to my dissertation.
Uh-huh.
So I hope to do that with Dr. Melanie Shire.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, and it's just I'm just so excited to. You know?
Yeah.
To be part of all that. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Randy.
Thank you.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.